An estimated 1.5 million American households, including 3 million children, somehow get by on less than $2 in cash per person per day. That figure, a measure of the country's extreme poor, has been on the rise since the 1990s, when welfare underwent massive reforms, adding work requirements and lifetime limits. Catherine Eden, professor of public health and sociology at Johns Hopkins, joins Midday to talk about her experiences examining the lives of those surviving without cash in extreme poverty. Where do these families live? How did they land in such dire circumstances? And does it matter that they have no cash if they receive benefits such as food stamps? $2 a day, living on almost nothing in America. That's next on Midday, after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. $2 a day per person. That's about how much cash is available to an estimated 1.5 million American households, in that number, 3 million children. It's a metric used by the World Bank to measure poverty in the developing world, and yet here we have it in the United States. In 1996, during Bill Clinton's presidency, a massive welfare redesign did away with a 60-year-old program that provided cash assistance on the basis of economic need. A new program replaced it, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF, T-A-N-F, imposed work requirements and lifetime limits on welfare recipients. In the mid-1990s, at the old program's height, 14.2 million people, including 9.6 million children, received welfare. By last fall, that figure had fallen to 3.8 million people. Fewer than 2 out of every 100 Americans receive cash assistance now. TANF, or classic welfare cash assistance, is so low that it doesn't bring a family's income to even half the poverty line in any state. Welfare's safety net has become one of non-cash assistance, food stamps, Medicaid. Catherine Eden, professor of public health and sociology at Johns Hopkins, is with us to talk about her experiences examining the lives of those living without cash in extreme poverty. She reports her findings in a new book called $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. Kathy Eden and her co-author, Luke Schaefer, a researcher with the National Poverty Center and a professor up at the University of Michigan in the School of Social Work, followed families with children living in Chicago, the Mississippi Delta, Cleveland, Tennessee, Johnson City, Tennessee, that were surviving on $2 a day cash per person. They looked at how these families got so desperately poor, how they coped, and why the number of households in this precarious position has been on the rise since the 1990s. Today we'll get some answers to these questions as we examine this along with Kathy Eden. It's a pleasure to have you on the show with us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
So let's make sure we get it right. $2 a day. Someone listening to our show right now might say, what do you mean $2 a day? Nobody can live on $2 a day. What you mean is $2 a day cash, right?
Yeah, and let me tell you a story about how we got to that number. It's a Baltimore story, although none of the sites in the book are or Baltimore. The roots are here in the city. I was here in 2010. I was living in Boston at the time, but here doing a study of young people who had grown up in public housing and who were in their early 20s. It was really a study of the transition to adulthood. Hmm. Now, way back when, at the very beginning of my career, I spent 6 years interviewing people who were recipients of the old welfare system, as you said, AFDC. And I'd run around the country, young person with a lot of energy, interviewing hundreds of these mothers about their budgets, about everything coming in and everything going out. So I kind of have a mental calculator in my head at all times. And when I got to the house of Ashley, who was at the Latrobe Homes, right there in the shadow of Baltimore's prison, I noticed very quickly that there didn't seem to be any cash coming into the household. Ashley was 19 at the time. When we arrived, she had a three-week-old baby. She was visibly depressed. Her hair was unkempt. She was actually having a hard time supporting her baby's head as she rocked her, which, of course, concerned us. There was virtually no furniture in the house except a trash pit couch and a filthy mattress on the floor covered with a Bugs Bunny fitted sheet. There was one table with only three legs kind of propped up against the wall and only one chair. So Ashley's sitting in the chair and I'm sitting on the floor, and I start asking her about her income and expenses. These questions reveal there's no food in the house and more worryingly, no baby formula. Now, this family was getting a housing subsidy, and we would later learn that about a fifth of the $2 a day poor capitalize on a very scarce resource. Housing aid is not an entitlement in this country, and only a few eligibles get it. But some do get this resource. But Ashley and her family, no one had a job. No one was even on food stamps at the time. They had no visible means of support. So I walked away from that experience, and over the course of the summer of 2010, I had several more experiences like this. And as sort of an old-time, you know, poverty researcher who'd gone off to study other things in the interim, namely the working poor, it occurred to me that perhaps a new kind of poverty had arisen right under our noses that we didn't even think existed in this country. So I started out by calling it cashless poverty, and soon others urged my co-author and I, Luke Schaefer, to use a rubric that was almost zero, but not quite zero. And they suggested we borrow this rubric from the World Bank. But we measure $2 a day poverty in big data and survey data the same way that our poverty threshold is calculated. People are asked how much cash is coming into the household. We throw in some other income, though, that the Census Bureau doesn't. We throw in help from family and friends. We throw in cash from side jobs. Anything that's reported to this seminal survey we draw on called the Survey of Income and Program Participation, which allows us to make the kind of estimates
that's just your big data bank.
That's the big data.
Okay.
Yep.
So in Ashley's case, she knows what cash is, so when you say, do you have any cash, she doesn't have any cash. In other households, maybe there's food stamps. Maybe there's a housing subsidy, as you say. This is all non-cash assistance. You're looking at dollars and bills and coins and what's there, and you come up with something like 1.5 million households in America.
Right.
With only about $2 a day per person in each of those households.
Yes, and that's what they're telling the survey. And you can see it also in food stamp records. You can see it in a number of other data sources that people appear to be living on virtually no cash.
Now, you didn't come up with that number.
No.
This data bank came up with that number. You just wanted to find out why and how do people live this way, right?
Exactly. So when you find somebody who's likely to report that they have zero income, what does that look like? And how does someone get into that situation? And what does it really mean? You know, what is the lived experience of $2 a day poverty? And so that's why once we, you know, looked at all of the survey and big data on this question, we went back to the field to put skin in the numbers, following 18 households over several years' time to really understand what it felt like.
That number, 1.5 million households, and within it, 3 million children, this is much higher than it was 20 years ago.
It is indeed.
We had welfare reform during the Clinton administration, 1996, basically said this is going to be welfare to work. You are going to be timed out. What, 5 years will give you some cash assistance, but then after that you're on your own, and you have to find welfare to work, right?
That's correct. And what's interesting about that story is up until the publication of this book, the line about welfare reform is that it succeeded. And indeed, an unprecedented number of welfare recipients did go to work. This was partly a result of welfare reform, but probably mostly a result of very generous new tax credits for the working poor that were initiated in 1994, also by the Clinton administration, ensuring that if you worked full-time, full year, you would not be poor. So, you know, in February, families can cash in this program, and it's a wonderful program. We don't want to paint welfare reform with one brush. I think there are winners and losers in this story. And in January, I published a book on those winners. And that was nice to write a story really about a policy success.
You mean the people women,
yep,
mainly, who had been getting cash assistance or were helped to work and actually were able to be take care of themselves and their families with income.
Yes, right. So folks who were able to work full time, full year, and as you know, because you've read the book, that's not a given, right? That's a prize. That's a prize in our economy now. We'll get tax credits that get them out of poverty, but they only get those credits if they're able to work full time, full year. So the more you work, the more you get. And for folks that are hanging on to the ragged edge of work, things are not so positive.
In Ashley's household and other households, when there's no income, no cash coming in, meaning nobody's working, some of our listeners hear that and say, why? It can't be that bad. Certainly there must be a minimum wage job available to at least one person in an extended family.
So this is a very striking thing. When you look at the data that the government produces, you would think there were plenty of jobs to go around. But if you spend any time in our neighborhoods here in Baltimore talking with folks, let's say with a high school degree or a little bit of college, getting any job is excruciatingly difficult. Getting a job with full-time hours is excruciatingly difficult. Getting a job where you know how many hours you're going to actually get, how many shifts you're going to be able to work, is excruciatingly difficult. Jared Bernstein, an economist at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, reviewed this book, said, you know, we have to face as a nation the fact that even at the bottom of the labor market, there are simply too few jobs to go around. So Walmart and Target might have 100 applicants to choose from for any given job. It's very difficult, and families do go for months without work. But the families that fall into $2 a day poverty are also fragile. Oftentimes, they have health challenges, both mental and physical. These health challenges both push you into spells of $2 a day poverty and are exacerbated by spells of $2 a day poverty. Ray McCormick, in Cleveland, Ohio, you know, we've known her since she was 21 years old. She's now 24. At the little local convenience store near her home, there's a picture of her that the proprietors put up from when she was 16 years old. And if you look at Ray at 16, then at 19, then at 21, then at 24, the weathering and the aging is just, it's stunning.
What happened to her?
Well, she's been actually living in $2 a day poverty on and off since she was 12 years old. Her father died. Her mother abandoned her, ran off to Tennessee with a lover. She was living in an apartment alone with only her father's Social Security death benefits and her pit bull, Sweetie, for several years, actually, with kind of the help of a neighbor until Child Protection Services was going after her, and her sister and brother-in-law finally came and moved her into an abandoned building.
This $2 a day is such a great book. It's a combination of research and data, but also these profiles, these personal stories. It's a work of journalism in part. Kathy Eden, professor at Johns Hopkins, our guest in this hour of the show, with H. Luke Schaefer. Their book is $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. If you have a question for our guest, and I have several more during this hour, please give us a ring, 410-662-8780. The email address for Midday is midday@wypr.org if you have a comment or question to share with us. We'll take a break now and go back to Andy Bienstock for more information about how you can show your support for WYPR during our fall membership campaign. And welcome back to Midday, our second hour, taking a look at the 1.5 million American households that somehow get by on less than $2 cash per day per person. Catherine Eden, professor of public health and sociology at the Johns Hopkins University, discussing her experiences examining the lives of those surviving on almost no income, just $2 a day per person. How do those folks survive, and how did they get into that situation? We're hearing little bits of that. I want to go back to welfare reform of the 1990s and come forward, because I would say, was that the beginning of the lack of cash, of the beginning of the end of cash assistance as we knew it before then? Here, I'm using a Bill Clinton phrase, the end of welfare as we knew it or know it. Because everything has sort of been transformed to non-cash, right? Medicaid, health insurance for the poor, food stamps. Is that the main reason why there's less cash in the hands of the poor?
We argue that it is. So consider the following fact. Prior to welfare reform, 68% of the poor were touched by the AFDC program at some time during the year. Now we're down to 25%.
Assistance to families with dependent children, which have been around for 50 years or so, right?
That's right, a 60-year-old program.
60 years.
Yep. And when we reformed welfare, that number began to fall. So we had about 5 million adults and their children at welfare's height. That declined to 4, 3, 2, 1. We now have 1 million adults on the rolls, half of them in New York and California alone. The other 500,000 spread across our 48 states. In many states, there's no functioning TANF system left. Now,
there's no cash assistance.
There's virtually
in
no
how many
cash
states?
Assistance in the rest of the 48 states. Some states do a little bit better than others. The average state, of course, the what we call the TANF to poverty ratio is 25%. Here in Maryland, it's 31%, so we don't do so well. We do a little bit better than the national average. Many states fall below that 25%. But what's happened is many millions of categorically eligible households are no longer going to TANF. Now, why would that be?
You're not even applying for it.
They're not even applying for the program. And it's really not the time limits. It's really not the work requirements. It's that people aren't even coming to TANF's door. So when we went out to the field in these four sites, we asked people. I remember asking Travis Compton. You know, his wife is the only resources coming into that household are from his wife Jessica's plasma sales. She sells plasma as often as the law will allow, twice a week.
Where do they live?
They live in Johnson City, Tennessee, and you know, we're literally sitting talking with this family. He's looking outside of the apartment window, waiting for the sheriff's deputy to show up to throw the family out. They're 3 months behind on the rent because, of course, you can't pay the rent with plasma sales. And we ask him, Travis, why haven't you gone down to the welfare office? And he says, what's that? In Chicago, we spent a couple of summers with Madonna and Brianna Harris, and they were in a homeless shelter. Over the weekend, there was no food available at the shelter. They only had a little bit of spoiled milk in their dorm-sized refrigerator that a charity had dropped by past its expiration date. You know, we have this 15-year-old girl who is just so thin and so hungry. And I said, Madonna, why don't you go down to the TANF house? And she says, oh, haven't you heard? They're just not giving that out anymore. She didn't know anybody who was on the program. When TANF becomes so rare, you know, the flow of information stops. Ray McCormick down in Cleveland, Ohio, finally goes to the TANF office in desperation after 5 or 6 months of living under $2 per person per day. She's got a little daughter who just started kindergarten, Azara, and she's told by the caseworker, honey, we've just got so many needed people. There isn't enough to go around. Come back next year. And at this point in Ohio's history, it's sitting on a substantial TANF surplus. And we have evidence across.
But why isn't it giving it out?
Well,
because people aren't applying for it.
So here is the fascinating thing: the way we have a lot of evidence that these informal diversions—that's what they're called—are common. And here's the incentive, the perverse incentive the TANF system offers states. So get this: we give $16.5 billion to states. The federal government does to fund TANF.
That's again cash assistance.
Cash
to
assistance
families, right?
To families. Our welfare program. Mm. But they've also said to states, oh, by the way, if you don't spend that money on TANF, you can spend it on other things. So currently, of that $16.5 billion, $11.5 is diverted to pay for all of the other things that states like to spend money on. And that they don't.
Not necessarily poverty programs?
Not necessarily poverty programs. It includes additional assistance to the working poor, child welfare, often is. Things as obscure as scholarship programs are funded with TANF dollars.
How many of the people you interviewed, women in particular, had gone through the TANF program, actually, you know, got some cash assistance, got a job, ended up keeping a job at the end of their time going through that?
No one.
None.
In our, No one in our study got anything from TANF at any point in their history. Most of these are younger
films. Okay, so none of them even bothered to apply. All these folks...
Only Ray McCormick had applied. And you know, this was very striking given my earlier field work. I mean, people knew what welfare was in the early 1990s, for better or for worse. I mean, we definitely don't want a society where people are shirking who could be working. But this is not that, right? This is people who are desperately needy, who are experiencing material hardship few of us can imagine, and yet they're not coming to the doors of our main welfare program.
Because it's sort of a word that's fallen out of the lexicon.
In some ways, yes.
Except when you get into a political argument with somebody about what's wrong with America, which I often do, I hear, well, there's too much welfare.
Right.
We're a nation that's full of entitlements, and people believe they're entitled to this, until there's still too much welfare. But you can pare that down to someone who says there's too much welfare. When you're talking about cash assistance, there's very few people relative to our history who are taking advantage of it now.
Yes.
And welfare to work, you report in the welfare to work concept, it does work for a lot of people, but 40% of those leaving welfare still don't have a job at the end of that, 4 or 5 year period when they can accept it, right?
Yeah.
When they're
eligible. Even if you went to the welfare office now, in most states, it's 2 years and you must be working.
It's 2 years.
And that's the federal maximum.
Oh, it is. I'm sorry. I stand corrected.
It's a five-year lifetime limit, but you have to have a job within 2 years in order to meet the federal mandate.
In order to continue receiving the benefit?
In order for the state to get reimbursed by the feds for giving you the money.
And you found that only 40% of people are actually coming out of it with a job.
Yeah, those are national numbers, not numbers from us. But we've known for a long time that people leaving welfare were not always leaving for a job. What we didn't realize is that the way states are scored by the feds is that they have to meet a work requirement. And you can meet the work requirement simply by shredding people from your roles. They do not have to have a job. So you can, as long as you keep bringing the numbers down, you meet that requirement, even if people are not leaving for jobs. So again, this is a real story of perverse disincentives. And in some cases, you could even argue that TANF has become welfare for the states rather than welfare for people.
Yeah. Well, let's go back a little bit then where all this started. Ronald Reagan's welfare queen anecdote. I always go to that, but it's a real thing because he campaigned against welfare in 1976, again in 1980. And by the time we get to the Bill Clinton era, the new Democrat, Bill Clinton is calling for welfare reform, and it's a bipartisan effort in Congress to end welfare as we know it. So now, actually, really, occasionally you hear people refer to welfare or entitlements, but that welfare is, it sounds like, it's not completely gone, but it's pretty much gone in most states, right?
Yeah. And just to think about this story, if you put together the gains from these tax credits that we talked about.
The earned income tax credit, correct.
Sort of the current system as it now stands, and then this rise of this extreme poverty, this $2 a day poverty. We have about 3.4 children rescued from poverty through tax credits in the course of a year.
3.4?
Yep. Million.
Million.
But so, we have about another 3.4 million children in our longitudinal analysis that are living for at least 3 months in extreme poverty. So...
$2 a day.
In the middle, right, we have about 2.8 million children who are getting something at TANF, from TANF at any given time. So it's a complex story, but the entitlement, was legally ended when AFDC was replaced by TANF, and that's been consequential.
Another voice I hear as we discuss this, because I hear this a lot, why do women have babies they can't afford?
I wrote a book about that.
I know you did. I was going to mention the title. What year was that, Kathy?
That was in 2005, Promises I Could Keep. And I did 6 years of intensive field work in Philadelphia and Camden, along with my co-author, Maria Kafalis, who's at St. Joseph's University. That's a fascinating question because my very first book was really about how welfare mothers make ends meet. This is how I got the calculator in my head. And And when I went around the country doing shows like this and telling people that you couldn't survive on welfare because it paid too little, mind you, it now pays 30% less than it did then, right, because the block grant hasn't been adjusted for inflation. People would say, well, why did they have the kids in the first place? Or why didn't they just get married? So being an intrepid young person, I decided to write to the National Science Foundation to get funding to study these two questions. I thought, hey, these are important questions. Americans want to know the answer. And I've been around single mothers, and I think they could offer an answer. And the National Science Foundation told me this was not a matter of national importance. But luckily, the W.T. Grant Foundation felt differently. And my two young children and my husband and I moved to Camden and lived there for several years to really explore this question. The answer is complex, right? Some people think that the poor have given up on marriage. They don't hold to that goal. We found in both our book on the moms and then the book on the dads that we published a couple of years ago, and I know...
With your husband, Tim Nelson.
Who was a guest on this show, that children hold tremendous meaning for young men and women in the inner city. They revere marriage, maybe almost too much. They put marriage on a pedestal. They think you have to sort of have your finances together, what they call the white picket fence lifestyle. They don't want to marry just to divorce. They think marrying in that way would be a sacrilege. So they're aspiring to marriage. They see it as something that really requires stability. A colleague of mine at Hopkins, Julia Burdick Wills, said, it's kind of like buying a house. It's not like you want to make sure that the school next door is going to be good next week. You want to make sure that the school next door is going to be good when your kid grows up and goes to high school. She's got a one-year-old baby.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what marriage is like. It's a long-term bet. And young people often don't feel that they have the kind of stability to make that long-term bet, even though they're hoping. And 70%.
Do they realize that getting pregnant and having a child, the child requires diapers and food and doctor's attention and expenses?
Yeah, so this is the fascinating thing, right? And I think, as we did this work, I really resonated with this. The there but for the grace of God go I sort of feeling that a field worker gets when they understand at a gut level why someone else does what they do. And, how many of us can live without a source of meaning and identity? None of us. And so children really are the chief source of meaning and identity in a world where so few opportunities in other venues.
And that's a very powerful force among young women.
Yes.
That you found in your research, more than the sort of practical thinking of, can I live on $2 a day? All right. We'll take a break here and come back and talk some more with Kathy Eden from Johns Hopkins, with Luke Schaefer, authors of $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. This is Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Another short break as we ask you to show your support for WYPR during this fall membership campaign. Andy Beanstalk standing by to tell you how you can do that. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks with Kathy Eden, professor of public health and sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Tomorrow night, Tuesday night, 7 p.m., Kathy Eden will be at the Barnes & Noble, Johns Hopkins, the bookstore right at 33rd Street and St. Paul, to discuss her book. 7 p.m. tomorrow night. Her book is $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America, which has received some terrific reviews. We were talking about marriage just before the break, or the lack of marriage, or why women have children outside of marriage, or when they're too young, they can't afford them. But several of the profiles in your book are of marriages, right? Families that are living on $2 a day.
So this is a very equal opportunity condition, right? We have a fairly large representation in the data of married couples. About a quarter of all the $2 a day poor are married. Half of the $2 a day poor are white, and 40% are clustered in the region the Census Bureau calls the Southeast, which is really Appalachia and the Deep South. So they're rural, and that's why we chose to follow who we chose to follow. We really wanted to represent the breadth of $2 a day poverty.
You know, Newt Gingrich, I think, is the one who called Barack Obama the food stamp president because of this transition that's taken place in this country, right? So there are people who say, well, non-cash assistance is the way to go here. We don't want to give poor people cash anymore. Basically, that's what has happened in this country. We're down to what, would you say, $5 billion?
Going into the pockets of poor people who are,
right.
That's right.
In cash.
In cash.
The rest is food stamps, other services that are available, maybe subsidized housing, maybe, well, certainly Medicaid.
Yeah.
But aren't we better off that way? I mean, do you really even need $2 a day if everything else is covered?
So this is such a great question. When I first went to Ashley's household, I sort of,
in Latrobe Homes in Baltimore.
Yes, in Latrobe Homes in Baltimore. I thought, yeah. You know, this is the cashless safety net, but I saw something in Ashley that really made me wonder whether this was a good idea. We gave her $50 at the end of our interview, and we arranged to come back the next day because I was really worried about that kid. And as you know, researchers are mandated reporters. So
excuse me, I just want to interrupt.
Yeah,
you go back to the description when you said before it looked like she could barely hold the child's head up.
That's right.
She seemed very hungry and weak. And the child had no formula.
The child had no formula, no food in the house.
So she's in a bad shape. And you want to give her some money. Is this an experiment or what?
No, we do this at the end of the interview. We pay people for their time.
Okay.
But when we came back the next day, just to make sure she was okay, she had gotten a home permanent. She looked terrific. She had gone down to the Goodwill on Broadway and bought a pantsuit. And she was on her way out the door, having left the baby with her mother, to a job interview. It was like...
How much time had elapsed?
One day. And, you know, again, this doesn't prove anything. You need to go to the numbers to look at this. But it seemed that there was something really important about cash. Because after all, you can't get a home perm with food stamps. You can't buy a pantsuit at the Goodwill with Medicaid. As we explored this question, what we learned is that about half of the $2 a day poor are getting food stamps, called SNAP, at any given time. As I said, about a fifth are getting a housing subsidy. Almost everybody has someone in the household with a government health benefit. That's something we've really triumphed on in America. But none of those things can pay for the essentials of life. So what the $2 a day poor do is they end up trading off some of those in-kind benefits at a steep loss in order to get the vital cash, because it's, as it turns out, they needed about $3 to $4 in cash to actually survive, you know, and they had to generate it sort of under the table. The most common way of doing this is selling your food stamps. Now, surveys show that food stamps only last about 3 weeks out of the month anyway. So we saw some very, very hungry households, because let's take Alva Mae Hicks down in the Mississippi Delta in the little town of Percy. You know, she's in a climate that ranges from 9 to 109 degrees in the last 6 months. She has only one way of paying her utility bill, and that is with her food stamps. So her household full of kids are the hungriest kids I've ever met. We ask her daughter, Tabitha, who has spent most of her childhood in $2 a day poverty, and at one point when she's 15, is actually preyed upon by a gym teacher who offers her food, you know, in exchange for sex. But when we ask her how it feels to be so hungry, she says, it feels like you want to be dead.
Did you run into anyone or encounter anyone who was benefiting from illegal drug sales? Their family was getting some cash from drug sales, marijuana, heroin, or anything like that?
So I'm an old hand at interviewing such folks, and we did not find that here. One thing that's important to note about the $2 a day poor, if you look at them longitudinally, is while only about 10% are getting even a penny from TANF over the course of a year, 70% have an adult in the workforce. So what that tells you is these folks see themselves as, and we're talking the formal sector workforce, right? They see themselves as workers. They've worked at Walmart. They worked at Liberty Tax. They've worked a little job as a waitress somewhere.
Or a temp, maybe.
As a temp. Mm. And what they want more than anything else is to be a worker. Second, they're the custodial parents of children, and you don't fool around with, with dealing drugs. It's very rare. No reputable study finds much activity in that regard among people who are custodians of children, because you're going to lose your kids to the state. So they were, plasma sales were common, debilitating.
How often can a human being sell plasma?
You're allowed to sell plasma twice a week. For some people, it really is debilitating. Jessica Compton, for example, tiny woman, 97 pounds, borderline anemic anyway. She panics every time she walks down to that plasma clinic in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, she always gets a library book. She's a real reader. She loves Nicholas Sparks. In case her blood registers too little iron, or in case her blood pressure is too low. In fact, she takes iron supplements in order to give, and it wipes her out for an entire day.
I was curious what your observations are about what people eat.
Oh, my goodness.
What do they get from food stamps? And are they savvy about food at all? Do they eat a lot of junk? There's a lot of obesity associated with poverty.
That's right. So at one point I joked that I could call this book America Runs on Ramen, you know, like the Dunkin' Donuts, runs on Dunkin', because ramen noodles are so common. You know, oftentimes you open the cupboard and you see nothing but ramen noodles. Mm. I could probably write a recipe book on creative ways to use ramen. And of course, this is very low nutritional value, very high sodium. So
you saw a lot of that.
We saw a lot of ramen and a lot of hunger. Now, we at one point took Ray McCormick to the grocery store because we were really interested in this story about food. And I've done work with the USDA following 90 families across the country as they shop. But for the $2 a day poor, the worst thing that can happen with your scarce resources is for food to spoil. And you often don't have a secure place to keep your food. For example, Ray McCormick didn't have a refrigerator, just a deep freeze. So when we took her shopping, she passed right by the produce aisle. And we're like, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. But as she explained it, you know, she was literally thinking, almost like somebody who was stocking up, you know, like we did in the 70s one of those shelters, a bomb shelter. You know, you're finding the staples that will absolutely be there for you. And then when you have very little cash, the cheapest way to get what moms call your four squares is at McDonald's. You know, you can get bread, meat, and vegetables.
Kathy Eden, we're down to our last minute and a half or so. It's hard to imagine this country going back to cash assistance. For anybody running for president or Senate or Congress saying, you know, we really need to help people in poverty by giving them cash assistance again and not requiring them to work necessarily if they can't, to or not putting requirements or whatever it is. It's hard to imagine that would happen again.
That's right.
So what do we do with 1.5 million households just scraping by on $2 a day?
Well, if you're going to have a work-based safety net, which is what we have, you have to have work. So what we argue for is a radical expansion of work opportunity. People have taken responsibility. They've taken personal responsibility in the way we wanted them to. They see themselves as workers. They want to work. And we need to pay attention to that, because work brings dignity. It does connote citizenship in our country. The best way forward is to figure out how to build more jobs, better jobs. We do need a safety net, Dan, because sometimes work won't work. And we need to deal with our affordable housing crisis. But at rock bottom, we call for a radical expansion of the opportunity to work.
Kathy Eden with Luke Schaefer, authors of $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America, HMH. Is it Houghton Mifflin?
Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
Thank you very much. I always want to say Houghton. It's Houghton Mifflin Harcourt is the publisher of her book. And Kathy Eden will be at the Barnes & Noble, Johns Hopkins. That's at 33rd Street in St. Paul, Tuesday night, tomorrow night at 7 p.m. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for your work on this.
Oh, thanks, Dan.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our midday for today. I hope you enjoyed the program. And if you like this program and the others you hear on WYPR, show your support by becoming a member or renewing your membership here at WYPR. Here's Andy Bienstock.